This is GamesAtWork.biz with Michael Martin and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with. This is episode 300, Never Gonna Give You Up. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Michael Rowe here on our 300th episode. Woo! With my friend, co-host, co-founder, and all-around incredible Michael, Michael Martin.
Hey, Michael. Michael, awesome to be here with you.
Woo!
what is an all amazing Michaels event, huh?
All the time.
I've been excited about this all week, you know?
I think I have. I probably tweeted about it.
You might have done it once or twice, and, you know, the day is here, right?
Well, what's so momentous to me about this is you and I did a podcast before this one. We called it Dog Year Nation, right?
We did.
Back in the day. And we got really excited about episode 200. We had custom shirts made.
Yeah.
We had, like, audio clips from our listeners, all kinds of fun stuff. We did episode 200, and then we decided we should completely reformat and rename the show.
I remember that time.
Yes, which was, you know, it was an idea. Well, now we've gotten 50% further, so at least it didn't completely kill us. Changed the audience a little bit, but for those of you who've stuck with us, these now 500 episodes between two shows.
Holy schmoly.
And, you know, I'm just looking forward to 500 or more. More.
Oh, yeah, at the very least, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, so it's fun. I enjoy, you know, getting at least 1 hour each week, sit down and just totally geek out on tech and games and technology and
work,
business processes and all that fun stuff. So thank you to all our listeners. And Michael, let's dive into all the fun that we've got set up for this week.
Oh, my. And we do have some fun. So, you know, longtime listeners of the show or those that are just brand new to it, you know, we talk about a virtual reality and augmented reality and all kinds of alternate realities, too.
All kinds
of realities. Start off with this Wired article about VR meetings and them being weird. there's a news flash for you right there, isn't it?
Yeah, if you've listened to our show, you understand weird and VR. This is interesting. I swear, every VR platform, AR platform, virtual world platform that starts off for meetings has at least one example that looks like this of weird, cartoony looking people.
Disembodied.
Standing around, disembodied, not really looking at each other, focusing on some data visualization.
Yep. Because, you know, you if you're going to be in a virtual meeting, you want to, like, be in a PowerPoint.
Yes.
Because that's what we all aspire to. Actually, yeah. You know, the funny part here, which I thought was really more funny than anything else, is that because of the uncanny valley type effect of the eyes staring off into nothing land, the solution here is to put sunglasses on them. So you look
on
like
every
a man
one
in black,
of them.
And so everybody's wearing sunglasses.
Yes, yes. I didn't think about that right away when I first saw it, but now that you mention it, it's like, yep, they all have the Men in Black glasses on, and they're also all wearing the dark suit with a light shirt, slightly different colors on the shirts.
Yep.
And no tie because, you know, we're hip now. We can wear jeans at work with our blue blazer and white shirt or gray shirt or blue shirt.
But it does look like, we were talking about the Venture Brothers just recently, and the character that is invisible from the elbows down. There are some pictures here of the Arthur environment where people look like they're typing, and that was sort of reminding me a little bit of the I'm typing. So instead of three dots like you get in messages or something like that, you would see the physical representation of somebody typing, so you would know that they're like actively about trying to share something in the chat.
Well, it's interesting. I was chatting with Epred this past week, and he had posted an article on a VR meeting that he was in, and of course, it had the full, you know, upper body torso
And then the hands, because I guess they were using Oculus or one of the other ones that have the hand controllers.
Right.
But since the controllers on the hands are not directly fully connected all the way to the chest, there were like these hands floating out in space, and then the chest and head. And everybody had these disembodied hands floating around because the controllers knew where they were in space, but they couldn't guarantee where the rest of you were. And that's what I thought of when I saw these, and I saw the little blinky, I call them blinky just because of the coloring of the, you know, the hands typing down there and the arms slowly fading down. They're kind of a turquoise or an aquamarine color.
Yep.
Little, anyway.
Well, yes. We're learning our way, right? And this is a continual evolution, and we've seen that now for quite some time. Last funny thing, and Michael, I don't even know if you know this about me, but I'll, you know, I'll share this with our audience. The name of this app is called Arthur. And so yes. The thing that struck me on this was Arthur's theme, which was, mm-hmm. believe it or not, my botched up audition for a musical when I was back in high school. And let me just awesome. Say, when you get to that high note, thank God they stopped me.
Yes. like,
thank you thank very you, much. Thank you.
We'll next. Call you. Don't call us. Next.
Yeah, won't do that for
no,
you.
No, just
here.
Leave the sheet music at the door. No. Just put it down.
That's
put
fine.
The music down. I've had those auditions.
So let's move into some fitness stuff. Let's yes. move into, you know, some, you know, more dynamic real life kind of thing. And funny that we were talking about Gauntlet recently here about playing with ePred, and all you guys mm-hmm. can do this on Steam Windows boxes, of which I have
we just
none.
Haven't made time yet to be able to do it. We've talked about it.
Okay, well, you know, that's you're one
so
step
you don't have
closer.
To feel bad.
But this is pretty cool about being able to do shadow boxing with these gloves that that allow you to kind of interact with people or games on the screen, right?
Yeah, that was actually one of my favorite games on Wii Fitness was the boxing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so you had the hand controllers that you kind of had to grasp like a fist, right? In order to do the boxing, but these look pretty cool, and I can imagine doing more than just pure punches. I can imagine doing more martial arts type thing. I see there's some kind of sensor and connector going from the hand and wrist all the way up to the shoulder, so you can get the full upper torso movement controls. So this looks pretty cool.
It does, and you know that when I was looking at the little GIF snippet down
animated
below,
animated GIF, yeah.
I first thought that those are connected, and sort of mentally, as you're thinking about punching, you do want to have your hand coming up and protecting your face as the other arm goes mm-hmm. out. But that's not what that is, right? So at least I imagine having my fists connected by a rope that goes around my neck. So as one extends, the other comes back to protect, and as the other extends, and so on. You're right; those look like more sensors to determine the full extension of the arm, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Very, very cool. And very cool. One of the other interesting things about this type of physical activity connected to a hardware game device or whatever is I think it's next Monday or Tuesday the Apple Fitness Plus is going to be made available, and I'm looking forward to trying it, you know, having gotten a new Apple Watch this year, because it's my, you know, every other year upgrade the watch cycle. I believe I get at least a 1 or a 3 month trial, so I'm looking forward to testing that out.
That'll be really, really cool. So next article, physics.org. This is an interesting one because we've talked about this in the not too distant past about having your body movement, right? So if you're doing shadow boxing or just even walking, that there's enough kinetic energy from your body that should be able to be captured by a capacitor and then transmitted to be used in wearable devices. Yeah. And it seems like we've got an example of that from a number of people in Penn State's Department Penn of Engineering State, yeah. Science and Mechanics lab, which is pretty darn cool when you look at it. It is a small, stretchable system that you can put on your skin. And what this suggests is that it can not just capture kinetic energy from movement, but also from breathing. And it's like, wow, wow, right?
Yeah, this is really interesting. I think last time we talked about this, my mind went to entropy, right? And how, you know, consuming energy eventually is going to cause a state of entropy across the entire universe as energy kind of evens out across all things. This time, my mind went somewhere totally different, especially when I read the part about human breathing, that it could capture the energy and charge from human breathing. Mm-hmm. I immediately went to the Matrix and the fact that we're all batteries plugged into the Matrix, because, you know, if you just got all these batteries sitting there and they have to breathe, right? And I'm wondering the transmission or the transference of energy from one state to another, right? The sun generates most of the energy for our planet, either now or in the past. Energy is captured into plants, into food, into animals, into other things, and it is stored until we cause a reaction and release that energy to be consumed by something else. Eating, as an example, is a way of transferring sun energy from a grain to baked bread that we eat, right? Right? So I wonder the efficacy of that energy transfer, right? Back mm-hmm. to my entropy state. but from a usage perspective, I do find this really cool. I seem to remember also, and I'll have to see if we can find this one, I think it was a bra that was collecting kinetic energy during exercise to charge your cell phone. I mean, it was. I remember some of these ideas in the last 3 or 4 years from CES and articles that came out around CES. But by the way, I don't know if you realize, I'm sure you do, the 2021 CES is going to be all virtual online this year. Or this coming year in a couple of
weeks. This coming year. Well, that's good. That way you won't get sick going to it.
I won't get sick like I have every single time that I've gone to CES since 2016. No, 2006.
You're breaking your record.
Yes. Sometimes I've gotten really sick. So sick that I was like held up in a hotel room while I was there. But the last couple of times, at least I didn't get sick till I got home or on the way home. But yeah, I seem to remember a bra that was using the kinetic energy from exercising to charge a cell phone. So we might have to see if we can find that one. But I do find it interesting that we're getting to the point where we can get to this capacitive capability that's very small, very thin, and potentially able to generate enough energy to do something meaningful. Not just charge a battery, but actually do something with the energy at the time.
Absolutely. And while I haven't really investigated all the underlying science here, they're calling them micro supercapacitors. And I should also give credit here, too, now that I've read this a little bit further, a couple of universities in China, including Mingjiang University and Nanjing University, were major contributors to this. So that's where the people came from yeah. Penn State.
So Penn State, as well. Mingjiang, yeah. And Nanjing.
Yep.
Very cool.
Yeah, awesome. And this bodes well, because this way you could use your new Apple Watch in your Apple exercise program and yep. charge it as you go, as opposed to it discharging while it monitors you.
Yes.
What a neat feature, yes. For us to invest in and think about. So moving right along, let's talk privacy. Let's talk health. Let's talk wearables. And we've talked actually about the Halo Band before.
Yes.
And the Washington Post, interestingly enough, when you consider the ownership of the Washington
Post. That's exactly why I saw this article. I was like, the Washington Post,
who is
owned by Jeff Bezos, who owns Amazon, did a review of the Halo Band saying this is the most invasive tech they've ever tested.
Yep.
Which just, you know, I think that was kind of our reaction when we first read about it. I guess it was 2 or 3 months ago when they talked about this. And I think that was kind of the general consensus across all the different tech podcasts I listened to. It had not come up yet because it wasn't out yet on the security podcasts that I listened to and follow. Yep. But yeah, the creep factor or the creepy factor was the mic always on microphone that listens for your tone of your voice. and then we'll kind of give you positive feedback to improve your tone.
Positive feedback like you're grumpy and annoying. Cut
yeah,
it out.
That's what mine would say the whole time. I mean, my wife and I have been watching a show. It's a multi-part thing on PBS called Hacking Your Mind, which was a really, really interesting view of, you know, the impact of social media and social networks and kind of the gamification of things, and how the business models and incentives drove towards division. And then they talked about, you know, hacking for good. Unfortunately, the example that they used in a negative way, which I'm okay with it, was the Chinese social credit score.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's the black swan kind of event. Black Mirror.
Yeah, and they went through it in a little bit more detail than I had seen over its initial launch. And part of it was, you know, the social network effect of how your friends of friends, your friends of friends of friends' behavior ultimately influences you.
Ooh.
Right? Ooh. So even if I don't know your friends who are smokers, if you have friends who are smokers, it is more likely that I will smoke, even though I don't know them at all and none of my friends smoke, right? And they were doing a couple of different examples on that. And they, using that same approach to do the social credit score in China, and then they talked about how you could do it for good, like health and all this other stuff, which immediately got me thinking about the halo, right? Because the halo is going to cause a feedback loop to say, Michael, you know, your tone of voice, come on, you know, your tone of voice, right? And so causing that feedback loop to change my tone of voice, because I am the voice of calm and reason on this show, could influence, you know, Andy's friends or some other listener's friends to be calm, voice of reason, which just blew me away when you start looking at that social network effect that we've been talking about for years.
Well, it goes beyond that for me, Michael, which says that if your friends are influencing me, then I ought to be influencing you to get rid of your negative friends that are influencing you so that I'm better.
And now you're right into the Chinese network social score.
Or, you know, I saw a picture that this was funny of a house in Iceland. I think it was like the most remote house ever. It's looked like it's in the bowl of a volcano. It's all nice and green now. And it's this little house bloop on an island in a bowl of a volcano. And the first thought I had for that was, oh my God, that lawn looks like it'd be murder to mow.
And then you thought of me.
Well, no. Now I'm thinking of you. It's like, okay, the only safe thing to do is in our social distancing world is like, okay, if I just get rid of all my friends, I'll be better, right?
Oh, yeah. That's it. That'll solve it.
That way I'm not going to be exposed to those wackos that are your friends.
Those loners are always the quiet ones.
Oh, okay, this band thing has taken it an entirely a new level. So maybe there's got to be a way that if there are behaviors that the band wearer, the halo wearer has, like they're interacting with a friend that I shouldn't like that they do anymore, I could create a feedback loop there to buzz them, maybe to shock them, so that I'm now doing negative reinforcement.
Yeah.
You know, don't talk to that person anymore because they're a smoker or they're doing something that I don't want them to do because I don't want to be impacted by that.
Yeah, it, like I said, interesting, very interesting. And the key thing here, to get back to the actual art, right, is of all the data that they collect, the feedback that they provide you is so minimal, right?
Now, it's not providing you feedback. You and I both know that. This is a harvesting operation.
It's a data, absolutely, absolutely. And the good thing is you're paying for it monthly.
Yeah, yeah, right. You buy the device. And then you pay for the service to give your information away.
What a bargain.
What a bargain. Oh, my goodness. All right. So
Speaking of, on
the other end of the spectrum, perhaps.
We hope.
Well, we do, but this will come across, you know, exceptionally fanboy-esque, I'm sure. Yes. We have the Apple story from The Verge here talking about the, what are they calling them now? Privacy nutrition labels.
Yes. Yeah. Matter of fact, wasted time. I had to fill out, I think we talked about this on the show a couple of months ago. I had to fill out the content. And this is the thing that the labels were to roll out earlier this year, and they got significant pushback by some large data collection companies. and so these are coming out. I'm glad that Apple is, you know, putting their money where their mouth is, so to speak, and using them on their own products, too. One of the things I've been thinking about as it relates to these privacy labels, I've got an app that I've been playing with for a couple of years. I haven't released it yet. Tracks what cards I send to people, right? Christmas cards, birthday cards, etc. Even bereavement cards. I mean, you name it. It you only want to have one in that list.
Birthday, I would pretty yeah, thing would be yeah. good.
Right now, all the data is stored locally on the person's phone using core data. And that's why I wanted to write the app, was to learn core data. But I realized that I have the same app personally on my iPhone and my iPad. And when I'm doing cards each year or different times of the year, I may have one or the other device next to me. So I need to synchronize across the devices. And I was looking at Apple's APIs for data storage on iCloud, right? And so there's really two choices. I can just create a local data store and manually synchronize it onto that individual's personal iCloud account, or I can leverage Apple's iCloud storage system and APIs so that I could do things like, and this is something I want to do eventually, build an AI classifier that, based off of the front of the card, predicts what type of card it is.
Ah.
Something I'd like to do.
Right.
And if I had, you know, 20,000 people using the app and they were all taking pictures, you know, I could say, you know, that's more than likely a Hanukkah card, or that's a, you know, an Easter card or whatever. Mm-hmm. Based off of the machine learning understanding what the front of the card looks like.
That's pretty cool. I like that, Michael.
Yeah. So it's something I've been playing with. But from a privacy perspective, that would change my nutrition label from I don't collect squat, it's all on your device and you maintain all of it, to some subset of the data will be used to improve the classifiers to identify the type of card you're taking a picture of. Right? And so it's got me thinking on, you know...
Do you want to do that?
Do I want to do that? Maybe. It seems like it would have value.
It
would be kind of cool. Or B, will enough people say, oh, God, it's got this creepy AI that's going to actually look at the card that I'm sending somebody?
Or C, let it all live on Core ML on device and have it just do the prediction locally.
But then I have to build the initial prediction model based off of having, you know, tens of thousands of cards myself that I can learn against. I've got to build that initial prediction model.
Well, right? Not necessarily. You can give somebody an empty set that you've tuned, right?
It will tune only based off of their data. So yeah. If they always get, you know, puppy cards for birthdays, then
it
I see a puppy and I go,
a puppy
it's a
on
birthday
the card,
card
is a birthday card.
Yeah. Yeah. So interesting design consideration when you think about, you know, all driven off the fact that privacy labels are coming to apps,
yep.
Which I think is absolutely a good thing. But understanding the usage of the data for the purpose that it needs to be there may either improve, deprove, or unprove the value. I'm making up those last two words. But you know what I mean.
Well, more consumer information is better than less. And once you start exposing this, then people have a way to make better decisions. And we've seen that before.
Absolutely agree.
In the United States, for example, on food and nutrition labels, which is kind of why I think Apple's choosing that word nutrition label, so that you could see country of origin, you can see what's actually in it, and you can make potentially better, smarter data choices.
Yep.
So
you got it.
Very, 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 very cool. I'm looking at our long list of things.
Yes, we got. We might want to skip a couple.
So yeah, so I think we are going to skip a couple, but there's two that I want to touch on super fast. One of them is 3D printing of homes.
Yes, and
Michael, you found this cool little example of more of an extrusion of a home than a printing of one, but it is a way of delivering a home quickly and fast.
Yeah, this was we've talked about 3D printing of homes before, and one of them was using basically Quikrete, right? Yep. And was really doing, you know, basically a pure cement house with the conduits for wiring, et cetera, et cetera. This example was using the best I can tell. It's almost like that insulation foam, and it was extruding out the liquid and then having it expand into the foam structure. And then they were kind of putting it into the walls, right? So they're building up the walls insulation and then putting the sheetrock on one side and the outdoor covering on the outside. What I really did like, though, was the design of the house. I thought it was cool. It was well laid out. I think it was like a four-bedroom house or something like that.
Yeah, and it's
like
kind
that.
Of rounded a little bit, too, which is also neat. I like that.
Yeah. It had lots of sensors and actuators in it and a whole lot of IoT stuff, and you know my love of all things IoT except for the creepy data collection part. So I was impressed by this. I wish they would have said, you know, an extruded house, because to me 3D printing, I guess it is extrusion too, but it was cool. It was cool. That's all I can say.
Yeah, no, I liked it, and I thought it was neat, and it relates pretty nicely to the next article as well. So this is an Ars Technica article, so we're sticking in the physics realm here a little bit more, and this particular one talks about the Kelvin equation that goes back to a paper written by someone of the same name to describe...
Mr. Kelvin?
Well, Lord Kelvin, to you, that was evaluating how sandcastles can be built. And
I didn't realize that Kelvin worried about that, right? Because Kelvin was 0 degrees Kelvin.
I think so. Sir William Thompson, later Lord Kelvin, was involved in a number of scientific things. And so apparently in this 1871 paper, there were some thoughts about what you need to make a sandcastle and what is the optimal amount of water to sand so that you have the maximum ability to build. And so there's a mathematical set of equations that help you to calculate that. And there is a further paper from Nature that was published by the folks from the University of Manchester, where André Geim and his team did something really interesting to describe it in full. So if you're really wanting to geek out, have a look at that. And if you want to just enjoy some sandcastles, there's at least one picture of such from this article.
Well, it's interesting because growing up, when we built sandcastles, we extruded them. Right. This is using buckets, right? We did the
drip method, right?
The drip method, right? Yeah. And it would build up almost like an Adobe type sandcastle, right? Which I think has a total different consistency on water to sand ratio.
Well, yes, and you could do a different level of optimization on that too, because I did the same thing at the state park and at the lakes where I grew up too, and did a lot of this drip sort of structure too.
Yeah, I'm just impressed that this one has arches, as well as, you know, I almost want to call it a bridge between towers. That is impressive work. Now, it could just be because they use frames to build it, but we don't know because they didn't show us the secret of the building of that specific castle. Yeah, I think this is one that I hope to have some time to read in more detail in the upcoming winter break.
And I'm looking forward to that too. All right, next on the list, couple of Rick Astley posts and
GY.
Well, I'll tell you why. So okay. There is a little newsletter that comes out from MIT every Friday, is it? It's called The Download. And in this episode or this edition of The Download, there was a fun article that was referenced there about Rick Astley, and about the number one Reddit top post of 2020 upvoted was a photo of Rick Astley that was actually posted by Rick Astley. And I found this at the bottom part of
Rick Astley's all the way down.
Yeah. I found this as part of the you can still have nice things component of this newsletter, which I really appreciate. And Charlotte G is the editor who handles all this. And I dropped a quick line to her to remind her that it wasn't just that in Reddit, but Rick Astley actually joined TikTok. Mm. And he called it Rick Talk. And if you feel like you need to be Rickrolled, well, congratulations. You got it from the title of the show. And we're never going to give up doing the show. So no. That kind of fits there, too. But yes. If you need to be Rickrolled, now you've got more than one opportunity. Just click through the links and you'll see what I mean.
Yes.
Now, let's come back down to Earth for a minute.
Just for a little while.
Just for a minute. And the next article is about SpaceX and about the landing of SpaceX and what happened as a result. And
this,
being
this
the space geek you are, yeah.
This was fantastic. I have a coworker who pinged me the day before this launch because they tried the day before, and at like T-minus 2 minutes, they had an issue and had to stop with the launch. So this was a test of another one of the prototypes that SpaceX is working on. It was a vertical takeoff, horizontal flight, vertical landing test, mm-hmm. right? And it was incredible. It really was. It was 7 minutes long. I watched from about T-minus 40 through the launch and through the touchdown back to Earth. So... takes off, goes straight up. Goes up. I didn't catch the apogee of the launch, but you could see the curvature of the Earth. So it was pretty high up there. It then flipped over on its side, and basically floated down, and I mean floated at probably hundreds of miles an hour, or 128 miles per second, or whatever that formula is, right?
Yep.
And then right before, I mean, it had to be hundreds of feet from what I could tell from the camera angle. It could have been further up before it landed. It flips back up to a vertical position, lands on its tail, and evidently a little too hard, boom, blows up. it was fantastic. I mean, they learned a lot, right? I mean, to me, this was a successful test. The fact that it blew up on the final landing position, I don't think, yes, it was bad, but I don't think it was a failure of the entire test. And so if you get a chance, watch the video, read the article. I was impressed by this. Matter of fact, today, before we recorded, another spacecraft was... I believe launching satellites somewhere between 11:30, 12:30 Eastern Standard Time. That had launched, I want to say a week or so ago. I did not get a chance to watch that today, but I'm hoping to catch the details of that. Really, really cool stuff.
Gotta love it. And it's space and space flight and the kinds of things that are happening right now. I mean, what an awesome time to be alive, right?
Yep. At least in space.
All right, so wrapping out the show here with a couple of last articles. The first one is we started with some virtual stuff. Now we're going to start with some games. The article from Wired UK about these miniature arcade machines. So these are 25% quarter-sized cabinets that, Michael, you and I grew up playing. Right.
I mean, not this size. I think we grew up.
We were playing the full size. And it's funny that they call them quarter size, too, because, of course, you and I both know this. Every game used to cost a quarter, at least in the U.S. It used to cost a mark in Germany, which was kind of like,
yes.
That was expensive to go yes. play video games in Germany.
And at the time, I think the dollar was 250.
Yeah.
So it was like, still expensive. 33 cents or something like that.
So in this day and age where it's easy to stream games and there are multiple streaming services that you can buy into and you don't have to pay for them, or you buy a game for a dollar and it's on your phone forever and you can play it forever, it's kind of interesting and neat to relive this just a little bit. And some of these basic games and the controls and the user experience around them are, I mean, shoot, they're still ingrained in me, right? Yes. I know some of the routines for Pac-Man and Defender
Miss
and a Pac-Man few of these things.
Pac-Man patterns,
right?
Were stuck in my brain for a very long time. And if you think about it, this was the foundation of in-game purchase.
it kind of was. And the quality of those joysticks, too. I mean, that's another thing.
Oh, yeah, like, you'd beat the crap out of them in the arcade.
Well, they had to be, right? You had to really be able to support that. And one of the ones they referenced in here was 1942, that little airplane game you'd fly around and do all this. So there are multiple vendors of these kinds of things. You can get your little cafe-style Ms. Pac-Man table, two-player dealy, if you want. You can get these. You can get others. The intriguing part of this article was just the level of nostalgia, sure, but it struck me, and that was the part I wanted to bring up, was around the cost of playing these games. Mm. Yes, quarter size, got it, quarter. But that to me is like, what a paradigm shift that we've taken in so many things.
Yeah.
Over the years.
And just to kind of wrap it up, speaking of the nostalgia of 80s video games. My wife let me know that Ernest Cline, the author of Ready Player One, had a new book out, which I kind of knew, Ready Player Two, which just came out a couple of weeks ago, I think. And he is going to be doing, and we are getting nothing from this, but I just want to share because I think our listeners like that music, like those games, like all the nostalgia for that time period. He's going to be doing a virtual book signing event with Barnes & Noble online next Wednesday evening, 7 p.m. Eastern time. I have it on my calendar. This is going to be fun. I'm reading the book right now. So.
Well, looking forward to that. Looking forward to our next episode, episode 301. And we will hope to see you all back here again very, very soon on gamesatwork.biz. See ya.
Thanks, everybody.
You've been listening to gamesatwork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at gamesatwork_biz or at our website at gamesatwork.biz.